Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
We already have our Judith Miller aluminum tube story, and that was the New York Times story of a couple of days ago.
A few days after the WikiLeaks documents came out, the New York Times reported that they showed Iran to be a threat to Europe. That after Iran apparently obtained a missile from North Korea. But it was like Iraq WMD stories all over again, according to our guest, journalist and historian Gareth Porter. He joins us to talk about his story in Interpress Service News that the Russians refuted U.S. claims of an Iranian missile threat to Europe. He is author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War in Vietnam. He writes for Interpress Service on U.S. policy toward Iraq and Iran. We asked him about his first reactions to seeing that the WikiLeaks documents were being used by U.S. media outlets to argue that Iran could target Europe.
Well, I read the New York Times story and saw that they did the usual thing. David Sanger, of course, was one of the co-writers of the story, and Sanger appears to have been given extraordinary power by the New York Times to shape their coverage of anything having to do with Iran. And Sanger has systematically, as I think I've said to you in the past on more than one occasion, has systematically taken the position and advanced the position that Iran is, in fact, going hell-bent for nuclear weapons, and that the National Intelligence Estimate of 2007 was completely wrong and needs to be changed, and he is out to make sure that that's going to happen. He's putting as much pressure as he possibly can on the U.S. intelligence community to do that, to come out with a new estimate that will essentially say what the Israeli intelligence has been saying all along, which is that Iran resumed their work on nuclear weaponization in 2005 and has not stopped since then. This is the agenda that the Times had. Now, as soon as I saw that, I went to the WikiLeaks site and I found the original diplomatic cable, and what I found was that it says something very different from what the New York Times claims. The New York Times played it up as though this showed that the U.S. intelligence community had reached an assessment that Iran does indeed have this mysterious BM-25 missile which can threaten European cities. And if you look at the diplomatic cable itself, it says nothing of the sort. What it says is that at one point in this joint threat assessment meeting of Russian and American specialists, the head of the U.S. delegation, who was a High State Department official, said that the United States believes that the missiles were turned over by the North Koreans to Iran in 2005. It did not express any more certainty than that. That's a very weak position to take, to say that we believe that. The Russians, on the other hand, explicitly refuted it with evidence over and over again, evidence of various kinds, pointing out, as I said, that there have been no tests, that there's no independent verification that the missile even exists, let alone that it was turned over to Iran, that these reports that have been cited claiming this have no reliable sources behind them, and that it simply does not make any sense. They pointed out that the North Koreans have never tested a missile even like that, that the missiles the North Koreans have tested have much, much shorter ranges, and that it's now been 4 years, and the idea that the Iranians would have bought a missile from the North Koreans that had never been tested simply does not make any sense. The Iranians are too smart to do that. So there's a lot of very strong evidence here that is provided in the diplomatic cable to refute the idea that this missile exists. And again, the news media, in this case the New York Times, the Washington Post, failed to reflect the content of the actual document itself that was released by WikiLeaks. Now, in today's Washington Post, there's an effort to backtrack somewhat from that coverage on the part of the Post, saying, well, experts now do not believe that there's very hard evidence to support the existence of this missile. And so, you know, they've partially backtracked, but they still did not cover what the Russians said in that meeting, interestingly enough.
Gareth Porter, just tell us what kind of led to your seeing this as such an important story when you did.
For one thing, I mean, I had the advantage of having done a story just 2 weeks ago, I guess now, on the Iranian so-called laptop documents, which took advantage of the fact that the IISS in London had done this very well done study of the Iranian missile program, which was critical to being able to show that the Iranians had already abandoned the missile and missile warhead that was shown in the laptop document. And so I was able to use that IISS study to compare it with what the United States was saying. And in fact, I interviewed the lead author, the senior author of that IISS study, and I asked him what he thought about what the Russians were saying in this meeting. Were the Russians being objective? Did they have political interests that were driving them to deny that Iran was a threat to Europe, that the Iranian missiles were a threat to Europe, or that they would be any time in the foreseeable future? And he said no, he thought the Russians were being reasonably objective. And in fact, that the Russian position in that meeting was very close, with very few exceptions, to what IISS had found in its own study of the Iranian missile program. And by the way, the Washington Post today, reflecting the views of people that they were talking to in the U.S. government, were still suggesting that the Russians were merely taking this position that the Iranian missiles were not a threat because they simply opposed the U.S. missile defense program in Europe. Well, that's not what the very expert from the IISS, Mike Elliman, who the Washington Post quotes in today's story, was telling me. He says that's not the case. I don't think the Washington Post actually asked the IISS specialist what he thought of the Russian position on this, because he would have told them the same thing he told me, that the Russians were being objective and that the IISS had come to the same conclusion the Russians did about this question.
In your story in Interpress, you described the kind of State Department threat assessments that really go on in the background versus the way experts on the region and the science actually talk about, you know, a country like Iran and whether or not they could actually have a missile to be concerned about right now or send it to other nations, you know, as far away as Europe.
Well, yes. Well, I think the key point here is that the position taken by the Russian experts in that joint threat assessment meeting of late 2009 in Washington, D.C., is very close to the one that has been taken by the most authoritative source on this question of the Iranian missile program, the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, IISS. In their study, which was published last spring, they cast very serious doubt on the existence of this so-called BM-25 missile that supposedly the North Koreans developed based on a now obsolete Russian submarine-based launched missile. And then, again, according to the legend, some press reporting and very shadowy intelligence coming from mysterious sources from these other official sources supposedly was sold by North Korea to Iran in late 2005. What the IISS wrote in this report, which has not been cited by any other journalist as far as I know, is that there is no really hard evidence or strong evidence for the existence of this missile. It has not been tested either in North Korea or in Iran. There's absolutely no evidence that there's ever been a test of such a missile. And it's now been 4 years since the reports first emerged of the existence of the missile, as well as the supposed transfer of this missile from North Korea to Iran, that Iran had purchased either whole missiles or parts or plans for the missile. So the IISS is very skeptical that the missile even exists. And this is exactly the position that was taken by the Russians in this meeting. And so I think this casts some new and glaring light on the methodology being used here by the U.S. intelligence community, if in fact the U.S. intelligence community has endorsed that position taken by the State Department in this meeting. And the question that it poses for me is whether we have another aluminum tubes scandal on our hands in terms of the U.S. intelligence community.
And where that would have come from and why? I mean, did a third party perhaps want Americans and Israelis to view Iran as more of an immediate threat than it is?
I mean, we have to go back to the origins of this story, of the existence of this missile. of the so-called BM-25 missile. There had been no report of such a missile, at least no name given to any missile, until the end of 2005. And just guess in what publication the first report, the first published report of the BM-25 missile occurred. It was in Bild, the German tabloid, which specializes in UFO stories and scantily pictures of scantily clad women. The story was sourced to an unnamed German intelligence officer or diplomat who cited German intelligence, a study or a report by German intelligence, which claimed that Iran had purchased these BM-25 missiles and gave it that name for the first time. Now, it soon became clear that the origin of that story was the Israeli intelligence community. It was Mossad itself, because the story then was developed by Israeli officials and journalists. The head of military intelligence for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, gave a series of interviews in early 2006, which culminated with an interview in which he charged that this new BM-25 missile could threaten European cities. And of course, that got the attention then of Reuters, the Associated Press, and they did stories which for the first time quoted this Israeli official talking about the BM-25 missile. So, I mean, this is really the origin of this story. There's no doubt that this came straight from the Israelis. And you have to then understand that to the extent that the United States has, to the extent that U.S. intelligence has bought this idea that there's a BM-25 missile, it reflects the impact of Israeli intelligence on the U.S. intelligence community. And, you know, there has been a very complicated relationship here between Israeli intelligence and U.S. intelligence over the years. We know that George Tenet, when he was head of the CIA in 2003-2004, was very leery of what the Israelis were trying to sell to the United States. It's been reported by a pro-Israeli news service that Tenet, you know, believed that the Mossad was trying to sell the CIA reports that were for the specific purpose of getting the United States behind an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. And he was resisting that, apparently, according to this report. And that fits with what I have seen about the CIA's position in 2003 and early 2004. Now, Tenet, of course, was kicked out of the agency. He was replaced by someone who was much more friendly to Israeli intelligence in 2004, and that represents the exact moment when the Israelis came out, I have reason to believe, based on the evidence, that the Israelis put out this set of documents, the laptop documents, which were fabricated to show that the Iranians were carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program. Documents which I've shown, I think, quite clearly were fabricated, and there's no way that they could have been authentic because, for one thing, they showed a missile warhead, efforts to redesign a missile warhead that was really the wrong missile. It was the wrong missile warhead. It was a missile warhead that the Iranians, we now know, had already abandoned in favor of a new improved version. And the idea that the Iranians would have been using that missile warhead as the basis for redesign doesn't make any sense at all. There's just no way that that could have happened.
There's been very little discussion about the true process involved in this leak and what it suggests about perhaps a group of people that are concerned that the United States military operation in the Middle East will escalate beyond the point where U.S. forces in particular can withstand the repercussions.
Well, I think it's been very clear for some time that the origin of the WikiLeaks document is one or more people in the U.S. military who had become very disillusioned with the entire military policy of the United States in the Middle East. And it's clear that we're talking here about not sort of selective leaking, but rather turning over the entire contents of this SIPR net, which was set up to share documents of secret or below in terms of classification. And that meant that you had 850,000 people who had access to these documents. It's very, very widely shared documentation. I mean, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about how this physically actually worked, that it was not sort of reaching in and picking out a selection of these documents, that these were the entire contents of CIPRNet, which were turned over to WikiLeaks by the disillusioned person or people within the U.S. military. The real question here is, once WikiLeaks had the entire contents of CIPRNet, these hundreds of thousands of documents, how they went about figuring out how to release them. And there, I think, you know, you have a lot of problems, a lot of issues that would obviously arise. They had to make some decisions about when they would release certain types of documents, which documents they would release, how they would release them, who they would release them to. And I think in the process, you inevitably have some judgments which, in retrospect, one can perhaps question. Specifically, I think that now one can question whether it was a good idea to release these documents to the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and The Guardian. I mean, three major mainstream news media outlets which have their own biases, which are not the biases of WikiLeaks and of the person who wanted to leak the documents in the first place. And I think inevitably what we've seen is that when they allowed these major news outlets to make decisions about what was going to be covered, it opened the way for essentially allowing the news media outlets to further their own narrative about the Middle East, and particularly about Iran, in a way that subverted the intention, I assume, the intention of WikiLeaks in releasing these documents. And this story, I think, perfectly illustrates the problem that WikiLeaks faced. And in this case, in fact, WikiLeaks had decided not to give the documents to the New York Times, knowing that the New York Times would, in fact, deliberately distort the selection and the interpretation of documents in order to support the kind of narrative that the New York Times has consistently taken and put out on Iran.
Well, of course, the media wanted a big story after the WikiLeaks documents came out, but the complaint that you're pointing to that the Russians had is that the science wasn't there.
Well, absolutely. This is a very important point. I'm glad you've raised, because one of the themes in this report that is very clear is that the Russians' position, the Russian approach to analyzing the degree of threat posed by Iranian missiles to Europe was to say, okay, what are the technical problems that the Iranians would face even if they wanted to have a missile that could reach Europe? And the Russians pointed out a whole series of technical problems that were quite serious that the Iranians were not anywhere close to being able to master or to overcome, some of which have to do with the fact that the original Russian missile was a submarine-launched missile. The missile on which this so-called BM-25 missile is supposedly based was a submarine-launched missile. Now, supposedly, the North Koreans turned it into a land-based missile, which is supposed to travel on land or to be put in a missile silo. And the Russians are saying there are very, very serious problems trying to convert this from a submarine-launched missile to a land-based missile. And the Americans were nowhere nearly ready to deal with those serious problems. They simply did not pay any attention to them. And the Russians complained that what the Americans were doing were modeling studies, which did not take into account some of these very serious technical problems. So I think that this is a very important thing to understand about what the U.S. government at this moment appears to be doing with regard to the question of Iranian missiles. They are going down the same road that the U.S. intelligence community went down with regard to the aluminum tubes. And again, it's presumably the weapons specialists who are oriented towards the worst-case scenario, the worst-case analysis of the issue, and do not care about the fine points of technical distinctions and technical problems, who are pushing this line. And The rest of the intelligence community is reluctantly either going along or is not going along, but the people who have the ear of the State Department at this point appear to be the weapons specialists in the CIA, the so-called WINPAC Bureau, the weapons intelligence people at CIA, who have been the most influential in the crafting of assessments of the Iranian missile program and the nuclear program as well, because they are the ones who actually have responsibility for writing the assessment, the official assessment. I mean, they can call on, and you know, other specialists who are regional specialists, who are national specialists, can have opinions on this, but it's the weapons specialists who have the say on what goes into the report and what doesn't, what goes into the assessment. And that has been a systematic source of distortion in U.S. intelligence about Iran, the Iranian missile and nuclear program from the beginning.
You know, will we see more Judith Millers now, or as the case may be, you know, more Sangers warping the facts into unrecognizable shapes?
It's already happening. We already have our Judith Miller aluminum tube story, and that was the New York Times story of a couple of days ago. This is precisely what is happening. We're having the same phenomenon of spectacular stories in the press. And again, it's the same newspaper, the New York Times, different author, but the same newspaper, pushing a line which coincides with the position of some people in the intelligence community, by no means all of them, and it's people in the intelligence community that have their own axe to grind who are pushing a line that is worst-case scenario. These are people who do not care about and are refusing to deal with the issue of intentions. The weapons people have never had any interest in the intentions of the Iranians. They simply assume the worst intentions and refuse to consider any alternative. And again, this is where the Russians were critical of the U.S. position. In that meeting, the United States never said anything at all about Iranian intentions. They expressed no view whatsoever. The Russians made it clear that they saw no reason whatsoever to believe the Iranians had any intention of trying to have a missile that would threaten European cities, much less Russia. And so, and they said so very clearly, the Americans never challenged that because they have no position on intentions. The U.S. intelligence community has never been able to come up with a common position on Iranian intentions on either missiles or the nuclear program, and therefore the U.S. is silent on that issue.
Gareth Porter, I know that the Russians have played a role in negotiations about an Iranian nuclear program, have made all sorts of offers, and at times that has diffused tensions, you know, between the U.S., Iran, Israel. But what is their motive, do you think, in being as strong in what they've said as they have been to you? I mean, you've got sources here like the Russian Defense Ministry, the Russian Security Council, the Deputy Secretary, Vladimir Nazarov.
I think what we're seeing here is that the Russian interest is to calm the waters and to sort of get the Obama administration to be less extremist in its viewpoint, and to recognize that there is no Iranian threat to Europe. That's a completely phony issue. And it's no longer the case that the Russians are simply opposed to any missile defense. They have agreed. You know, they've agreed to cooperate with the United States on some kind of missile defense system. What they object to is the idea that the United States is trying to sell this on the basis of an alleged Iranian threat to Europe, which they clearly deny. So you're right that the Russians have played a constructive role in the issue insofar as they have made that point privately. The Russians could probably do more to make it publicly at this point, and one of the interesting questions is whether news media will, in fact, do anything to ferret out that story, to ask the Russians to go public with their view on this. What are they saying now about this?
I'm speaking with you even as the Iranians are burying a nuclear physicist who had been working on their nuclear program. So, you know, this attack on scientists, what does that do to increase the importance of the story that you've been working on?
Two of the names of scientists that have been fingered by the MEK, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, obviously working closely with Mossad. And so there's no doubt that MEK and Mossad, either together or you know, I mean, obviously in cooperation, let's put it that way, were involved in this operation.
Are you suggesting there's a possibility he was assassinated by the West? Because I know, you know, obviously that was the immediate discussion. And, you know, I found myself wondering on various levels. Information has just come out about an Iranian nuclear program. We've just seen the WikiLeaks and this explosive information about the Saudis and their view on what should happen vis-a-vis Iran.
Well, I think that you have to believe that the very high likelihood is that this was something that Mossad either directly or indirectly was involved in carrying out, because of the background here that Mossad has, you know, made it known publicly that they have covert operations involved in Iran with disrupting the nuclear program through direct action, including assassination. I mean, they have made no secret of the fact that that's on the table as an instrument of policy, Israeli policy toward Iran's nuclear program. And they have, of course, used the Mujahideen Khalq in the past for various purposes, you know, mainly to filter or to be a conduit for intelligence, so-called. Misinformation, I think, is perhaps closer to being accurate, about the Iranian nuclear program, to get that to the IAEA and to the broader international community. Whether they would use the MEK to carry out an assassination of scientists is another question. This might be something that the Mossad would do itself with its own agents.
You're saying an authorized assassination?
Well, absolutely. This would be completely authorized at high levels by the Israeli government and carried out as a matter of policy, yes.
Any thoughts on where this story and this policy toward Iran might be heading?
Well, I think that the issue of U.S. policy toward Iran is, in fact, very much in turbulence within the Obama administration. And one of the signs of this was a recent study issued by the U.S. Institute of Peace in collaboration with the Stimson Center. And I attended the launch of that study three weeks ago. And what was interesting to me was the point being made very strongly by one of the key co-authors of the study, who was saying that the problem here is that the Obama administration has never fully negotiated agreement internally on what its position really is on the Iranian nuclear program. There are people in the administration who are still pushing the line that the United States must oppose any uranium enrichment by Iran. That has to be the bottom line. And specifically, he didn't name names, but he mentioned the non-proliferation people, and that means Gary Seymour, who is the special assistant to Obama, who is also the major advisor to the president on weapons of mass destruction. And clearly, Seymour has had a major influence on U.S. policy, and he is a dead-ender on this question of making sure that the president does not support any or allow any Iranian uranium enrichment. And that position makes it impossible for the United States ever to have any agreement with Iran, because the Iranians are never going to agree that they have no right to enrichment. And so we're really stuck here until the president can knock heads together and get agreement to go ahead with a position that would at least say to the Iranians, we are not going to try to prevent you from having any uranium enrichment. This is simply not a position we can take. And let's negotiate on the basis of your right to enrich and see how we can have an inspection regime which would give us assurances against nuclear weapons and go from there.
Author, historian, and journalist Gareth Porter, his 2005 book was Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.